Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining us once again. I'm Patrick Connor for QueensburyRules.com, and shortly joining us will be James Foley of BadLeftHook.com. Holy cow, we have a whole lot of stuff to talk about today. First and foremost is the absolute destruction, light heavyweight destruction from HBO over the weekend. First off, we're going to be talking about Adonis Stevenson's absolute thrashing of Tony Bellew, and then after that, Sergey Kovalev, who shot down Usmail Sitlok in two rounds on HBO. Should be some pretty epic stuff today, needless to say, and James should be joining us any minute. A lot of stuff going on in the light heavyweight division right now, it seems, or at least at the very top. It's not a very thick division from top to bottom, I'd say, but at the top, there's some pretty heavy action going on, especially in terms of punching power. We saw Adonis Stevenson basically kick the crap out of Tony Bellew. No offense to Mr. Bellew. I know he came to try and he fought hard. But he just didn't really seem to be in the same class as Adonis Stevenson. That said, Mr. Foley's with us. James?
Hello. Patrick, sorry.
How are you, sir?
I'm good. There was some slight technical difficulties.
No worries. It seems to happen from time to time, but if you start cutting out mid-sentence, I might throw a shit fit. We'll see what
all
happens.
All right.
Well, anyway, there's so much shit to talk about today.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I guess it's pretty coming up, and some good stuff on Saturday. So I'm ready. I'm fired up.
Before we get too far into our recapping and previewing and all that type of stuff, I just wanted to quickly say that it's my wife's birthday today, and I wanted to give a shout-out to her because I told her I would, and also say, my tits! Or her tits, whatever it was. So yeah,
oh, yeah, that's awesome. It's awesome. She's letting you do the show on her birthday.
Yeah, that's basically why I'm giving her a shout out, because she could very well be here kicking the shit out of me right now for doing this. But we're on the show. She's generous, and she's letting me do it. So anyway, what did you think about Adonis Stevenson, Tony Bellew over the weekend?
I think it went about as expected. You know, Stevenson has just he's looked really good the last couple times out. I mean, he's actually a pretty good boxer, pretty slick, and you know, has a very measured attack and obviously punches with some power. And I thought he did a good job, but you know, it was a tough act to follow.
Yeah,
coming
no
after
joke.
the Kovalev fight. You know, I mean, that guy is just oof. Love that guy.
Yeah, in comparison, it did kind of seem slightly underwhelming. I mean, if that would have been the main event and Kovalev hadn't have fought Sitlok in the co-main event, you know, it probably would have been a different story. But still, it was a good performance.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think he pretty much won. I thought he won just about every round. You know, maybe Bellew had one early. Yeah, you know, he eventually caught him and got him out of there. I think Bellew showed a lot of heart, but you know, he was just overmatched.
You know, it's
so, I mean,
it
didn't time
really...
for.
Well, if you wanted to give him a round or two, I'd be fine with that. I think it was the second and maybe the third round he was doing all right. You know, using his legs to okay effect. And,
oh, actually,
you know,
he did
really
have kind of a moment.
That's fine.
Yes, and I forgot. He did seem like in one of those rounds he actually caught Stevenson with a good punch that might have shaken him up a little bit for a second. So I forgot about that.
There were a couple times. Yeah, there were a couple times when he stepped forward and kind of landed in combination. And I was tweeting that during the fight that I didn't really like the way that basically, you know, he was reacting to the punches.
to me, it looked kind of like he was freezing up a little bit when he was getting hit, even though he didn't really seem particularly hurt. He was just, like, standing there, you know. I didn't really like that a whole lot, but it didn't really wind up mattering.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was another piece of evidence that, you know, to me, I don't know. I'm a believer in Kovalev, you know, and I think he's going to destroy Stevenson, to be honest. I mean, I've been liking Stevenson too, you know. I mean, since knocking out Chad Dawson, I mean, that's a big one. But I also thought he looked awesome against Tavoris Cloud. But you know, you look at those two guys, and you know, the fact that Stevenson does look a little bit vulnerable, has been knocked out before against a puncher like Kovalev, I just don't see it ending well for him. You know, so I understand where I'm kind of like all over the map because I was a little rattled by like some activities prior to the show. But, you know, after the fight when Stevenson, you know, obviously HBO would like to set up Kovalev and Stevenson, and I think that's a great fight. When Stevenson kind of like demurred from that and suggested that, you know, Frotch or Hopkins would be better opponents, I understand where he's coming from, and I think it has nothing to do with, you know, avoiding Kovalev. But he makes a valid point that, you know, and those are bigger money fights for him, and there is the revenge angle for, you know, avenging the Canadians with both of those guys having beaten, you know, Butte and Pascal. So those are probably, you know, bigger events in Canada and more money for him. You know, and you also have the winner of Pascal and Butte when they fight would be a big fight up there for Stevenson. So it sucks because he kind of does, you know, he does have more attractive options that would also be, I think, you know, less threatening, better fights for him, you know, in terms of his chances of winning. Because I think Stevenson's a really good fighter, but, man, just fuck Kovalev. I mean, that guy, I'm not going to pick against him until after he loses.
I didn't read a whole, you know, shitload of recaps about the fight. I mean, that's just kind of how I am. It's no disrespect to anybody who is a writer, but it's just the way that I do it. I don't read every single recap. You know, there are a handful of guys hearing from.
Do you read bloggers or real journalists?
That's a stupid question. Of course I don't read bloggers. Fucking jerks. I don't read those guys. No, there are a handful of guys that I like hearing from after fights when they write stuff up. And so I can't remember who it was, but it was either Starks or David Greisman, who pretty much said, you know, would you expect, basically just pointing out the stupidity of having a show where both of these guys are kind of co-headlining. Well, Adonis Stevenson was headlining, but regardless, the clear intent seemed to be that they need to be matched together either next or real soon. And so the stupidity of not having that happen anytime soon would just be somewhat enormous, really, especially after the performances they just turned in the other night. You know, they were dominant, scintillating, you know, exciting performances, and that's what people want to see. And then matching up guys like that, it's just guaranteed action. And, yeah, that's what people want to see, isn't it?
Oh, hell yeah. Well, yeah, of course. I think that, you know, they both kind of, especially Kovalev, the way that he's just completely destroyed these guys. I mean, with Stevenson, there's still maybe some caveats that, you know, Cloud, not really that great of a fighter, had already been kind of exposed, outboxed soundly by Hopkins. He was almost 50. You know, he was getting his, basically, you know, Campillo was boxing his ears off for the entire, you know, last third of that fight. And then, you know, with Chad Dawson having drained himself to get in, then being knocked out by Andre Ward, you can't, you know, it's not like he's beating guys coming off great wins. And, you know, Belu is a tough fighter, but he's not quite on that world-class level either. You know, I'm not saying that Kovalev's been, you know, running through a murderer's row, but, I mean, he's had pretty, you know, competent, credible opponents, and it hasn't even been close. I mean, you know, I think Cleverley is a good fighter. I mean, you can look at the comparison between, you know, Cleverley and Belu and then what Stevenson and Kovalev did to those guys. And Campillo, obviously, pretty good fighter. You know, it might have been a little bit shop-worn at the time and maybe more fragile early, but, you know, Kovalev never gave him a chance to get in that fight. And, you know, again, here, you know, so it just, yeah, everyone would love to see it. And I think a lot of that is because we're starting to believe, you know, fans love guys who can knock people out. And that's why, you know, Golovkin's been so captivating and Matisse before him. And Kovalev's now, I think, is right in that vein. I mean, Stevenson's a good boxer with a good punch, and he's, you know, he's had his own share of highlights this year too. So yeah, it's that's what we want. But Stevenson, you can kind of understand him going in a different direction.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I think that it's fair to kind of afford him that, I guess, or at least not give him a whole lot of shit for that, because I
Patrick,
get it. He's not young either.
Hey, I'm Patrick. I'm going to jump off for a second and call right back in like 30 seconds.
Yeah, no problem.
Carry on. I'll be right back.
No worries. I'll be here.
James will be back. Anyway, on to kind of what he was saying. I think that basically the two biggest attributes that you're looking at in Kovalev and Stevenson, needless to say, is punching power. Although I think that both have proven that they both have skills beneath the surface, needless to say. They both have, you know, amateur experience. They're both – or actually, you know what, I don't even know if Adonis Stevenson has all that extensive amateur experience per se. But in his last few fights, he has shown that he has better skills than we thought he had previously in any event. However, the punching power is the biggie. It's kind of tough for me to really quantify Adonis Stevenson's punching power for reasons that James was talking about, that even though you can pick apart just about anyone's recent ledger or, you know, go on to BoxRec and start picking out the things wrong with opponents or who somebody could have fought instead and all that type of stuff, you know, he has shown a little bit more skill, but it's kind of tough to say against these opponents whether or not the punching power is on the level of a Sergey Kovalev, who just looks so concussive when he lands. Adonis Stevenson, he's had that one huge knockout against Chad Dawson, sure, and the stoppage of Tavoris Cloud, but there are a lot of other kind of extenuating factors in those wins, as James was talking about. So, James, if you're back, and I'm pretty sure you are.
Yeah, sorry
okay.
About that.
No, no worries.
Setup was all fucked up.
No problem. If you had to kind of guesstimate as to whether or not their punching power is comparable, what would you say? Stevenson and Kovalev, that is.
I mean, it looks to me like Kovalev has more, but to me the bigger issue is their respective chin. Who is going to stand up to the other guy's punch? You know, and I think with Stevenson, you always kind of have to think that, you know, we've seen him hurt. I haven't seen Kovalev hurt. I've read that he was got a little bit, you know, knocked around in a fight. Might have also been against Darnell Boone, the guy who knocked out Stevenson. But I don't think I saw that fight. So, I mean, I've only seen the guy, you know, coming forward, destroyer, and I have seen him take some punches and walk right through him. So, I mean, that's the bigger. He just seems sturdier to me and maybe a bigger puncher. But, I mean, there's no doubt Stevenson's a huge puncher. Cloud has a really good chin. He didn't really knock Cloud out. You know, he basically just beat him around the ring. And, I mean, he landed some huge punches on Cloud in that fight and didn't knock him out. So, I don't know. It's one of those questions, though. It's hard to, you know, I mean, we haven't really seen them fight the same opponent, but from the looks of it, I mean, Kovalev, it's like, doesn't even look like he lands completely clean, and he's knocking guys out.
Yeah, he does. I mean, we keep talking about these, you know, Golovkin-like characters, just because that seems to be kind of the standard now when talking about mythical level punching power. And so I think that Kovalev, you know, it is at the very least approaching that reputation. So that's really what it looks like, though. You know, a guy puts his gloves up and he punches him through the gloves and still, you know, hurts the shit out of him. That's punching power, needless to say. And I mean, I know we did preview, you know, Kovalev versus Salak last week and everything. We talked about the Grashev loss and everything and all that stuff, but I mean, he really, he really wanted to kick the absolute shit out of Ismail Salak the other night on HBO, and that's pretty much what he did. I mean, the type of stuff he was doing was just, it was kind of scaring me, James. It really was.
Hovering
over him after he knocked him down and, like, talking to him, like, I'm going to gut you and all this shit. I'm like, what the hell, dude?
He's got that kind of, like, charismatic Russian mobster, you know, action movie vibe. He definitely...
He's a killer.
Yeah, he's pretty menacing dude. And you know what? The other thing about a guy like him is, like, the final knockout sequence is you know, perfect because he really, I guess, probably hurt him with that first punch that, again, didn't look like it landed totally square. It kind of bounced off the side of his head, but obviously hurt him. And then once Salak got up, he was done. I mean, he clearly couldn't stand there. But on that final knockout, you know, it wasn't just like he hit him with one punch, two punches. I mean, three punches he hit Salak with, two of them while he was on his way down. You know, so he has that killer instinct of which is awesome. I mean, you think about all the matchups he could get involved in. I mean, he would get his shot. It's just what sucks is that economically, they're probably going to have to put a pretty big offer to get Stevenson to do that because he does have safer, more lucrative options. And, you know, you can't blame him for taking those.
Yeah, and, like I was starting to say earlier, is he's like 36, too, and 35 or 36. So, yeah, his options as far as he's concerned are fairly limited.
And he'll be the younger man by 14 years if he fights Hopkins.
Oh, Jesus, dude.
That could be a really ugly fight, actually.
Yeah, I don't even want to think about it.
You know, Frotch fight is not bad if Frotch wanted to go up to 175 and do that, but I doubt that he does. You know, he may, I mean, and who knows if Hopkins is interested in fighting Stevenson. So Kovalev might end up being his best option because the other ones may not happen. I mean, Frotch has a ton of stuff on his plate. I've never once heard him mention, Stevenson. The one that I think could actually prevent the Kovalev fight is if the Boutte-Pascal winner, I don't know what their relationship with Adonis is, if they're like friends or something like that, but that seems like a kind of a no-brainer fight to make.
Yeah,
you know,
needless to say,
Canada.
I'm sure that there will
be
some effort. I don't think that I would. I wouldn't mind any of those fights. I mean, on their own, these are all good fights, and I'm down to see all of them except for. You know, it seems like at this point, Kovalev versus Stevenson is a kind of strike while the iron is hot type of thing. And, you know, maybe people like both guys and they don't want to see either one get a loss. And I can understand that. I mean, they're both likable inside the ring and all that type of stuff. So I get it, but I want to see that fight. That's still at the front of the list of what I want to see. You know, the other ones are fine, but those other ones can also wait, too. I mean,
if you're not like a
Donovan
promoter.
Yeah, and whether he loses or not will be big.
Fight Kovalev, yeah, of course. I mean, he's clearly, I think, emerged as the number two guy in the division. And maybe you could make an argument for Hopkins, but I think Kovalev is probably, on paper even, the best challenger for Stevenson, being the light heavyweight champion.
Yeah, needless to say. And, well, that's the fight that it seems that most people want to see. Even if they made a Frotch fight, that wouldn't be on my number one for either guy, really. But I'd be fine with it, and I'm sure that it would be, you know, fireworks as long as it lasted. But, yeah, Kovalev-Stevenson, or Stevenson-Kovalev, since Stevenson's the champion. That's what we want. So hopefully that's what they give us.
I mean, the problem is that nowadays with all these TV contracts and stuff and, HBO, it's like fighters, sometimes they kind of get an overvalue, they overvalue what a fight like that is worth. And these guys, I don't think I think Kovalev wants it for sure. But a guy like Stevenson might say like, hey, like if this is such a big fight, and you guys want to see it so much, well, you should, you're going to have to pay some ridiculous sum that's like three times what he's ever made before. You know what I mean? Because that's the problem. Is like now it has been built up, and we do all want it, but it's not that huge. It's not going to do some record rating on HBO. I mean, the mainstream, nobody really knows either of these two guys yet. You know, if a guy like Golovkin is just barely blipping that radar. I mean, these guys are way behind that in terms of the popularity and momentum and things like that. I mean, Stevenson might be big in Canada. He's not the biggest fighter up there. He's not as big as Boutte or Pascal. He's probably getting more and more popular. But as far as, like, the HBO money's involved, I mean, you even heard him alluding to it after the fight. Like, you're going to have to pay, you know, if you guys pay up, then it'll happen. I mean, that could potentially be a problem. But at the same time, HBO doesn't have a whole lot else going on for it. So it should be one of those fights they should target and should be, you know, if they're paying, $4 million for Andre Ward and Edwin Rodriguez, you know, maybe they can make this happen. I'm sure Kovalev's never had anything close to a $1 million payday.
Yeah, I think that goes to suggest that the priorities might be a little out of whack there in terms of who they're paying and what they're paying them. And at least as far as how it's dialed into what fans want to see, that is. But, speaking of HBO, though, and they even they mentioned it on the broadcast, and I just wanted to bring it up because it was sad, but I thought it was interesting. First of all, they said that according to Kovalev and Silak, that back in, you know, former Soviet countries and in Russia, it seemed as though the fight was kind of like a 50-50 fight and that it was, you know, somewhat highly anticipated. And then there was the pre-fight thing with Silak that, I don't know, I thought that was a little bit crazy, especially since he was laughing through how he was getting called the N-word and all this type of stuff, you know, when he was younger because of his mixed race. And did you wind up catching that?
Yeah, I saw
that. It was pretty short.
I saw that.
Silak
seems like a really likable guy, too.
Yeah, it was a little brutal there. I didn't really expect that.
Well, I saw Lampley, dabbing a tissue into his eye, so I think he was moved by that, too.
Yeah, needless to say. And then there was Chuck Ciampa. Oh,
he was just dumbfounded by the whole thing.
Yeah, he didn't even know what to say.
It was kind of moving, but it had that inevitability to it. I think I was thinking Silak maybe could give him do some stuff, but man, he got ruined by Grachev, you know. And not to say that he was something more special before. I mean, he probably always had that flaw, but that fight really kind of exposed how easily he could be hurt, and against Kovalev, that, you know.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I can't imagine being Ismail Silak and then, you know, in the pre-fight with my trainer or whomever, sitting there watching footage of Sergey Kovalev just destroying these guys and thinking that, you know, I lost my shit during, you know, the Denis Grachev fight. And I might now be having doubts in my mind about my own stamina or chin and all that type of stuff, you know. And it's like chumming the water and then jumping in a shark cage, you know, just really testing fate, really. So, yeah, I just can't imagine what that would have been like for a guy like Ismail Silak going into that fight with
I had forgotten that Grachev was a former, like, kickboxer who actually took up boxing pretty late, and I don't think he had, like, much of an amateur career. And then we all saw what happened to him against Edwin Rodriguez. So yeah, I think if you really looked at it and you think about just how much more refined Kovalev is than Grachev, and if a guy like that was going to catch Silak, when Silak was really boxing great in that fight prior to that, you know, if he could get caught in that fight, it was, you know, this was going to be a short night. And I would appreciate. Oh, I actually had to flip away. Did they interview Tony Bellew in the ring after the fight?
I don't remember them doing it. If they did,
okay,
they might
I know they usually don't interview. Guys on the undercard. But, I mean, I would have liked to have seen that. And that's the whole thing is, like, yeah, you show that kind of compelling backstory about Silak. You know, at least if the guy wants to have a couple words afterwards, you know, maybe you could let him comment on it or whatever. Although I guess he was badly hurt at the same time.
Yeah.
So maybe he should.
I was going to say, they might have been Yeah, they might have been legitimately worried about him, because, I mean, that it was one thing that, you know, for that initial short combination to land, and then he went down, and I was so surprised at it, because it was quick.
Yeah,
and then
that
he
tech.
Got up, and was just...
that was
well, he looked fairly clear-headed. Like, for a moment there, he got up, and he wasn't really wobbling about, but when the camera panned out and you saw his legs, he was like, they were fairly stiff. He wasn't going anywhere. And then Kovalev shot out at him before he could even make a move, and it was just boom. He was knocked out, like, through the ropes. That was just brutal stuff, man. So, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if they're like, yeah, we're not interviewing this guy. We're not going to have him accusing the ref of gambling or something.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Bad call.
Not that that's
I was trying to pull a Jim Gray, run up there and ambush him. Hope that he says something stupid.
What happened in this fight?
But
I just got fucking knocked out.
It just reminds me about how some of these guys, like Silak's a guy who had this, you know, everyone thought he had a really bright future a couple years ago. He has that kind of shocker against Grachev, and now here he is, you know, and it's like, yeah, they just come in and, you know, gets blown away by Kovalev, and now he's going to be, you know, you'll probably never see him again on American TV.
Yeah, I wouldn't imagine we'd be seeing him all that soon. I mean, I guess if you wanted to put him in like a Friday night fights type of thing, that's fine with me. I don't have any problem with seeing him again, but yeah, definitely not as a serious hope against anybody, not like this. It's pretty clear that it's not happening at this point. So yeah, put him in something lower level. That's cool. Speaking of, you know, guys who are having issues getting on TV, or at least that's what's been reported, Guillermo Rigondeau is fighting on HBO this weekend. So he's fighting Joseph Ogbeko, who was, of course, in that Showtime Bantamweight tournament from a couple years ago that I was very thrilled about when it happened, and it did wind up producing. You know, aside from that first Abner Maris versus Joseph Ogbeko fight that was just infuriating, the entire thing was pretty cool. And Joseph Ogbeko wound up coming out of that, I thought, looking fairly decent, but as has been the fate of just about every Don King fighter in the last 15 or so years, inactivity has plagued the guy. I know that he's had some, from what I've read, he's had some promotional issues with Don King. So he's coming off a bit of a layoff. Rigondeau is coming off somewhat of a layoff since fighting Nonito Donaire. It's a little bit of a strange situation as far as the intangibles going into this fight. How do you got this fight pegged, James?
I got to go with the more proven commodity and go with Rigondeau. I think he's just I kind of have a feeling that Ogbeko's style is perfect for Rigondeau to kind of look good against, and that you know, he'll be able to kind of like box going backward and set up his counter punches and find openings. I don't think he's going to knock Ogbeko out, but I think it'll be a clear enough decision. But it's an interesting fight. I mean, Ogbeko is definitely a really credible opponent, I think. I think that there's potential that he could make it exciting. You know, we're basing so much of this on how amazing Rigondeau looked for the most part against Donaire. Prior to that, I mean, he had a couple fights where he didn't look spectacular, you know, or where he got, you know, clipped a little bit. Was that Marroquin on the Chavez-Martinez undercard?
He had a little bit of trouble. I mean... He wasn't losing a whole bunch of rounds, but he didn't look great.
Yeah, he beat him handily. But, I mean, there were a couple moments in the fight, you know, where Marroquin landed some punches. So, I don't know. I mean, it's just like his stock is so high right now, and, you know, you've got to buy into that, and you got to assume that he's gonna get it done. I mean, he's probably just a better fighter. He's also, I think, fought, you know, in fighting a big super featherweight like Donaire. I mean, and the fact that he's been at 122, Ogbeko's coming up, that's, you know, that also plays into his advantage. So I don't see a lot of ways that Ogbeko could win the fight. I think that there is potential, though, that he could make it interesting, and you might see Rigondeau actually have to open up a little bit.
Yeah, I'm kind of intrigued by the matchup as is. I mean, Joseph Agbeko is a guy who, you know, generally likes to throw a lot of punches, likes to kind of charge forward, dart in and out when he has to. And he's also, I remember, against Yanni Perez in the second fight, he wound up showing a little bit more boxing prowess than a lot of people thought that he had. And so I think that it could get somewhat interesting, but it kind of depends on where Agbeko is at. You know, he's, I think, 32 or 33, which, and once again, for a smaller guy, not very young. Neither is Rigondeaux, but in terms of the punishment they've taken in a professional career, there's no comparison. I think that if you're going to look at just the skill, there's no question Guillermo Rigondeaux is the more skilled of the two. But I'm looking at these layoffs, and I mean, Agbeko's had one fight in 2 years, so that kind of worries me for his chances, especially a guy who likes to be active and likes to expend a lot of energy in the ring. So yeah, I think that I'm definitely leaning towards Rigondeaux. But as far as you know, getting Rigondeaux in particular on TV, I mean, it's Agbeko is one thing. He's with Don King. You know, that's just kind of how it goes with Don King these days. But with Rigondeaux, it seems like we should have already seen him on TV at this point. You know, I mean, the Donaire fight was in April. There have been
April
dates. I mean, yeah.
So that's, what, about 8 months?
Yeah. It was in early April. And that was our first show was when we were I think our first show was recapping that, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. Well,
in any event, what do you think?
Yeah,
do you
I
think
mean,
that there should have been a better effort for that?
I don't know, because I don't know if I ever really bought into that stuff about, you know, HBO doesn't want to air Rigondeaux, HBO refuses to air Rigondeaux's fights. Well, it's like, hey, I'm watching Rigondeaux on Saturday on HBO. It's only, I mean, 8 months. Yeah, you're right. I mean, at most he could have fought maybe one fight in the interim, and maybe there was a TV date. I mean, I don't know. I think it's also, you know, where he's at with HBO, there's not a lot of really good opponents that they have. I mean, that's look at Agbeko. It's kind of coming out of nowhere after we haven't seen him since fighting Mahrez. I think, like you said, he has maybe had one fight definitely wasn't on U.S. TV since then. So, I mean, there might have been a couple issues, but I never really believed that deal. I mean, Rigondeaux, you know, dismantled Donaire, who was one of the HBO, like, poster boys. And, you know, you had Kellerman just effusively praising him every chance he gets, and they mentioned him on the fight game. So it seemed to me like Rigondeaux was always part of that, you know, part of that HBO equation. Maybe they were just trying to figure out what the best, you know, best way to bring him back. So I think, you know, maybe, this could be encouraging. Maybe they are trying to set up a rematch with Donaire, and they wanted to get, you know, get Rigondeaux on one time before the end of the year. I don't know. But obviously he's part of the HBO, you know, lineup because they're running this against a Showtime quadruple header. So it's not like they needed to do this card.
That is true, but there's a flip side to that coin as well, which is maybe that's why they put him on this card that's opposing a quadruple header, because they're just like,
yeah.
Well, we're not really going to get ratings on that shit anyway, so whatever. But
this
can't possibly beat
Showtime in ratings, right? I mean, every time they've gone head-to-head, HBO usually wins, no matter what the cards are, but the Showtime card's got to be able to beat this one, right?
I would think so. I mean, there are more fights. The fights are of a slightly higher quality, I think, although it kind of depends. I mean, I think that there's potential for both cards to be fun, but I don't know which one I'm going to be watching live. It kind of depends on how it times out, you know. But, well, as far as Rigondeaux, I don't mean to suggest like there's some, you know, umbrella conspiracy about not getting him on television or anything like that. And I don't mean to place any blame on HBO specifically either, especially when, you know, the immediate aftermath of Rigondeaux beating Donaire, and since we've heard from Top Rank, well, specifically Bob Arum, multiple times saying he just doesn't really know how to promote the guy and he doesn't really want to put any effort into doing it. And so we've talked about it before, and I don't want to belabor it too much, but I do think that they could be doing more, especially since Nonito just fought recently. Although that's also kind of on Nonito to be pushing for that fight, I think, and he sounds a little lukewarm about doing a rematch, in my opinion.
I want to fight your boy. Gulp.
Yeah. He's your boy,
he wouldn't
right?
even say the man's
that,
name.
That guy?
Patrick.
you know, the Cuban. That
yeah.
guy. I'll fight him. No. You know, it would be nice for him to show a little bit more fervor, I guess. But whatever. Either way, we are seeing him fight this weekend, and I think that there's a pretty good chance that the guy that he's in with, you know, Ogbeko might show us some tricks and might show us some of his old self, but he also might just kind of come forward and get hit a lot. There's a good chance of that happening, too.
I mean, you got to appreciate Rigondeaux now, I think, in the same way as a, you know, Andre Ward, Floyd Mayweather. And this is kind of like, I think, the fights we've seen from them this year. You know, Rigondeaux is going to, he should be able to pretty, you know, handily outmatch his opponent here. But he, I think, you know, this will enable him to kind of show off a lot of his, you know, the things in his arsenal and, he, you know, let him look more spectacular than he has before. Because, yeah, the Dener fight was really polarizing, you know, and a lot of people appreciated the mastery of it, and other people kind of criticized, you know, aesthetically how he fought. But I guess if you like him, you know, this is definitely looks like more of a showcase than a really competitive fight.
Even
though Ogbeko's tough, it's not to say that he's not. It's just that, you know, what Rigondeaux revealed against Donaire, really proving himself as a pro on that world-class level, and now, you know, being regarded as one of the best boxers in the whole sport, Ogbeko shouldn't really be able to compete with him more than maybe troubling him a few times throughout the fight.
Yeah, even stylistically, all of those kind of extra little tidbits aside, stylistically, I would have to say that I'd favor Rigondeaux just because he seems to do well against fighters who come forward. And Ogbeko, like I said, I think there's a little more nuance to his game than just a brawling type of guy. Regardless, the style should favor Rigondeaux, all things being equal. So I am actually looking forward to that main event. It does have potential to be crappy, but it does have potential to be good too. But on the undercard, the fight immediately preceding that, or at least that's how it's being billed, is going to be James Kirkland's triumphant return against Glenn Tapia. There's going to be so many black pills in this fight, James.
Yeah, I forgot that was on this card. I was kind of waiting with anticipation as you were announcing it, because I'd forgotten what fight it was. Yeah, man, this fight looks pretty awesome. You know, I think probably on, you know, the best action fight of the whole weekend in terms of the HBO and the Showtime cards. I'm
yeah.
definitely down. I mean, Kirkland's entertaining as hell.
He doesn't really seem to, you know how to be in a bad fight, even if he's getting, you know, wasted by Ishida. Still gets to be entertaining.
Yeah, no,
that
was memorable too.
Yeah,
and looking
indeed.
Like he was going to get just drilled by Angulo and then storming back and, you know, turning that into what it became. I know I've seen Glenn Tapia, and I'm trying to remember, like, what his last fight was. Do you have that handy?
Yeah, it was against, what's his name, A.B. Han, I think was his last fight. Or maybe his last one. No. That was in the summer. On Friday Night Fights, he fought A.B. Han, and Han, I remember, just absolutely had a fucking ridiculous swelling on, I think, the side of his head / his eye, and he was getting beaten up but showing a hell of a lot of heart, and then he had a few moments here and there, but he wound up, like, getting knocked down and then had to, you know, retire in his corner. But the last dude that he fought was that guy Elko Garcia, that kind of wily character.
I saw that. Was that Friday Night Fights too?
No, that was he's a Mexican dude, and I remember his nickname was the Animal, and that was a co-feature for something, but I didn't dig that deeply in my research. Of course, now I'm just going to look because I can't remember what it was, but it was shit.
I remember the Abby Han fight.
You know, it might have just been like Showbox or something like that. But in any event,
I think we're probably obviously more familiar with Kirkland because he's been fighting, you know, higher profile for years. And I don't know really what to make of this fight because it's kind of billed as, you know, it's almost like a crossroads type of fight. I mean, this for Kirkland, you know, you have to beat Glenn Tapia, but Tapia is a pretty, you know, decently regarded kind of prospect, you know, would-be contender on the rise. And, you know, there's people that I read giving him a pretty good chance here against Kirkland. But, you know, personally, I mean, I don't know what to expect because I think Kirkland is, you know, becoming one of those, you know, incredibly unpredictable fighters, almost like Victor Ortiz. And he's been inactive for a while, but even before, you know, especially with the Shida fight, I mean, it's like, okay, pretty much anything can happen with this guy. I'd like to see him win because, you know, despite all his legal problems, he's always come across to me as kind of a good kid, a gentleman. And, you know, I think it's an interesting angle with Anna Wolf being his trainer. And he just fights in a really exciting, you know, action style. And he obviously has a lot of power. And, you know, he showed some stuff getting up against Angulo and coming back. You know, he showed that he does have heart. And he was trying to get up against Ishida. And, I mean, I still don't know what the hell happened that night. Joe Cortez just jumped on top of his head, but, you know, he was still trying to get up. I mean, I have no idea how he got knocked down in the first place, but so there's a lot to like with Kirkland, and, you know, I would like to see him move on and try to get back in the mix and be a player at 154, but I have, you know, I have no idea what's going to happen. And Tapia looks like, you know, stylistically the kind of guy who, you know, it will be an exciting fight.
I think that it probably will come down to the, you know, experience or perhaps lack of experience on Tapia's side against the, you know, inactivity of James Kirkland. It's so tough to decipher exactly what's going on in his head and in his career right now. I mean, the last time that we saw him, you know, that was against Carlos Molina, and he was looking like dog shit for most of the fight.
Wow.
Yeah, that was in, I think, 2011. I think late 2011 or something like that. And he looked like hell. He didn't look very good at all until the very end, and then the end got botched because, you know, it looked like the round had ended and the bell had rung, and then one of his cornermen stepped in. The fight got ended because of that. It seemed like a miscommunication at best. It was terrible. And then, of course, you know, James Kirkland immediately after that wound up coming out and saying that he was slipped black pills before the fight or something. And, you know, litigation, blah, blah, blah. You know, kind of the almost like the stereotypical boxing story aside from the black pill thing. That was new and somewhat novel. But
like a sci-fi twist.
Holy shit. The only thing we needed was like some little creatures like to place in his ear, Rathacon style or something. It was horrible. But in any event, it's just so another one of these kind of weird pre-fight assessments where it's tough to figure out exactly where James Kirkland is, and it's tough to figure out what Glenn Tapia can do. But I will say this, there's going to be a shitload of like muscly men in that ring when those guys get in there, because both those guys are basically physical specimens.
Yeah, they're
getting excited. Just
sweaty,
talk about that.
Half-naked, writhing bodies. And that's why we
watch.
Oh,
man, Rob Arum's going to love it.
Yeah.
Rob Arum's going to love that shit. Just like how he loves MMA.
Well, if...
Yeah.
No skinheads, though.
So what do you... No. No skinheads, ever.
Yeah, which MMA
plus
is.
Plus, those guys are all gays.
Obviously.
What do you think is going to wind up happening then? Do you think James Kirkland is going to come back and look like a beast, or do you think he's rusty?
I haven't seen Tapia that much, and he hasn't fought against any level of competition close to where Kirkland's fought. So I want to believe in Kirkland. You know, because he's the guy that I know. But hey, if Tapia comes in and has an awesome performance and it's a good, really good fight, and he gets, you know, a great knockout or he wins, you know, a bloodbath, then, you know, he will become a more relevant guy. But I have no idea what's going to happen. I mean, it's James Kirkland. I'm honestly surprised the fight hasn't been canceled yet.
I was surprised just to hear about everything, you know, supposedly coming together for him. Really, I mean, he, I guess, reconciled with Ann Wolfe. You know, he's been training with Ann Wolfe again, which is, it sounds like that's good for him. It sounds like that's been a successful, you know, mixture for him in the past. It's just, you know, he does, like you said, he does seem like a nice dude. He doesn't seem like a bad guy, but I do have to, at the very worst, question the decision-making skills of a dude who is a felon and then buys a gun at, like, this, like, roadside gun show. You
yeah,
know?
That's fair.
And then,
that's fair.
Yeah, it's just some of his career decision-making has been very bad. So I just wonder where he is mentally coming into this fight. That's a big thing for me. But Glenn Tapia does look like a strong dude with good hand speed and decent power. So when they meet, like you said, probably going to be the best action fight of the weekend. I'm really not sure how it's going to turn out at all.
Yeah,
like you said, James Kirkland. Who knows?
Black pills. You'd think that, you know, definitely, man. I mean, if Kirkland is the Kirkland of old, and I mean, that's what he does. It just throws volume, and that's, you know, if he's throwing a lot of punches, Tapia is going to be throwing a lot of punches back, and it should be exciting. I mean, there's no way this is going to, you know, these guys are going to try to box each other. I mean, Tapia may try to box for a little bit, but, yeah, it seems like a can't-miss fight. But it is one of those fights that's just weird because everything you hear about Kirkland, you know, he's, like, you know, been missing for 2 years, and every story about him is some bad, you know, new legal development. And then he kind of just popped back around, you know, and it was like, yeah, he's promoted by 50 Cent now, and he's back with Ann Wolfe, and he's fighting Glenn Tapia. And it's one of those things where it's like, I almost have to see it to believe it. You know, I'd completely forgotten this guy. And, of course, we all, you know, he was the Golden Boy before. And now he's coming back and he's on the HBO side of things. And he's fighting kind of an interesting prospect.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense. I mean, he was an opponent for rumored an opponent for Canelo at one point. And, you know, he fought Carlos Molina, who now has a belt. So it seemed like there were he was involved in these big fights. And so that's why it's kind of strange.
And didn't he, like, price himself out of a Canelo fight or something? He wound up saying, I'm not going to fight for less than X amount of money, and then it was, like, exorbitant fee. Yeah. Oh, yeah, and then said he was injured.
He was injured, but if they paid him $1 million, he would fight with the injury.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Not sure exactly.
But yeah. Not the sharpest crayon in the box, needless to say. But, you know. Hopefully he makes for a good fight on Saturday. Well, immediately before that fight, it's going to be Matthew Macklin, who is returning from being, kind of...
good boy.
Yeah, kind of a good boy against Gennady Golovkin from that body shot in round three against Gennady Golovkin. That was in early July, late June, I believe. So he's returning against Lamar Russ. I actually had to go look Lamar Russ up because I wasn't very familiar with him. I mean, are you familiar with him? He's fought a handful of times in Chicago, but I...
Oh, really?
I had
no, I'm not familiar.
Yeah. Yeah, he fought a handful of times there. I can't even remember where he's from, but his nickname is the Boxing Q. I'm not entirely sure what that means. It says
the
Boxing
Q
under his nickname.
The letter
it's
Q or like the waiting
Q-U-E.
The waiting list Q?
No, not even Q-U-E. That. It's actually just like, yeah, like if like as if he were Mexican, it would be like the Boxing K?
Huh.
Who knows?
Yeah,
I don't know.
I don't know.
But
I had never heard of him until he's the replacement opponent for somebody, right? So Willie Nelson was going to fight Macklin? Because that would have been kind of worthy.
Yeah, and, you know, that would have been a pretty decent step up for Willie Nelson. And as it is, it's a pretty decent step up for Russ, too. He's undefeated.
yeah, it's a big step up.
Well, he's undefeated. He's 14-0, 7 knockouts. And I wound up looking him up on YouTube, of course. You know, I did a whole lot of research for this. But he looks like a fairly competent fighter, moves decently. You know, I actually liked his footwork more than anything else. The only two fights that I saw were
I saw one against, I believe it was his last fight, Latif Mundy, or I think. And then I saw a knockout of his against Jose Alonso. That was one in Cicero, Illinois. It's from Cicero Stadium. That was on, I think, Univision. Anyway, those
yeah, I try to avoid the Cicero fight.
It wasn't really the guys that he fought were not very good. So obviously he looked good, but it didn't really look to me like he would be quite on Matthew Macklin's level, even if Macklin's coming off a knockout loss. You know, Matthew Macklin, I feel bad for the guy because he's a good fighter. He just kind of got trashed by Golovkin, and he's, you know, 2-3 in his last five fights. And the three losses have come against Felix Sturm, Sergio Martinez, and Gennady Golovkin.
Wait, Patrick, this is where we have to revive the old mythology. He was beating Martinez until Martinez scored a miracle knockout in the 11th round.
Yeah, well, that's what they say. I don't think he was beating him. I thought he was doing decently. But, and plus he had looked hurt even before he got stopped in that fight, like we've talked about before. But, you know, I do feel bad for him, though, because at the very least, those three losses come against, you know, three of the guys who are on the upper echelon of the 160-pound division. So,
top
you know,
men.
It doesn't necessarily
–
top men. Doesn't necessarily hopefully you got that. Doesn't necessarily reflect badly on him, you know. And so I'd have to think that going into this fight, he's probably going to be gunning for to get Lamar Russ out of there, and probably will.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you even share the same ring with Triple G and can't beat Lamar Russ. But who knows? You know, he's undefeated. Sometimes we just don't know with these guys. But it seems like he's just, you know, Matthew Macklin should be pretty far out of his league, and having fought the competition that he has, you know, he should be a pretty heavy favorite here.
Actually, now that you mentioned that, I totally forgot to say, I actually did, I wasn't kidding, I did do a little bit of research, and I found out that Lamar Russ had been a sparring partner for Gennady Golovkin and Edwin Rodriguez. And I mean,
really?
You can take that for what it is.
Dude, I'm taking Russ by knockout. I changed my pick. If he was even anointed by Golovkin as a sparring partner, that's enough for me.
You know, I mean, I watched a YouTube interview of him talking about it, and so I don't really know how credible, you know, it is as far as what his opinion of the sparring sessions were.
No, but that is worthy. That is something worth, like, big to know.
It is. No, it is, and that doesn't mean nothing. You know, he's obviously got to be at least somewhat tough if he's hanging in there with Gennady Golovkin, because, you know, and not just in hyperbole, but it sounds like Gennady Golovkin goes fairly hard at some of his sparring partners. So, yeah, I'd have to give him some credit, but it's still sparring. That's really all it is at this point. Well, I guess we'll have to see.
Well, it's always safer to go with, you know, the more proven guy. But if you know, if you're going to take that leap of faith, I mean, I you know, if Golovkin is the man, you know, guiding you forward, then it's somewhat reassuring, you know. So I mean, if Golovkin's going to vouch for Lamar Russ, then I'm kind of favoring Russ now at this point.
But now I'm just envisioning Lamar Russ hitting Gennady Golovkin. And then Golovkin just kind of like peering through that little opening in his headgear going, you serious? You serious?
That could happen. If Golovkin comes out, if Golovkin comes out and is working his corner, then it's done.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, then that would just totally change my pick right then and there.
Yeah, obviously. But we'll see. This was just like promised to Macklin because it was like he had a return date on HBO, right, from agreeing to get massacred by Golovkin, since they needed like some kind of credible opponent for Golovkin, since he never really had fought anyone, you know, top ranked middleweight. Because this fight, I mean, it's not good. This is like, Pacquiao Rios undercard level bad. Again, man, top rank is just, or HBO. I mean, it's like cool they're trying to do a triple header, but I mean, come on.
Yeah, at some point, if it's going to be like that, you can just drop that third fight, I guess. But
I mean, this
I
pretty
know,
much
it
could
be
like
interesting.
It could be interesting, but it is kind of it does kind of at this point feel like kind of a Friday Night Fights matchup, which I don't give a shit.
It's definitely
I mean,
not
hey,
high level.
I'd rather have another fight, an extra fight to watch because hey, it could. You're right. It could be interesting. We don't know Russ. If he gives Macklin a good fight or beats Macklin, I mean, that's a notch in his belt. We gave Golovkin all the credit for it. So, you know, there's something at stake here.
It could be Lamar Russ's coming out party, really. I don't know. Probably won't be, but it could be.
And then calls out his former sparring partner?
Oh, man. Now that would be actually be a time where Gennady Golovkin says, "You serious?"
Yeah, Golovkin would. But man, you know what? One thing I just wanted to mention real quick. I really wish, you know, in that Kovalev interview with Kellerman, when you know he was like, "Who do you want to fight?" and he was kind of like, "Oh, you know, Adonis or whatever," like kind of, you know, beating around the bush a little bit. And then Kellerman was like, "Okay, give me one name," and then he was like, "You know, I want Adonis," at the end.
Yeah.
I really wish that when Kellerman was like, "Give me one name," he had called out Andre Ward. Wouldn't that have been awesome?
That would have been awesome, yeah. Well, of course,
just
somebody would have given him shit.
Spine.
Well, somebody would have given him shit, I'm sure, because they'd be, you know, oh, he's calling out a smaller guy and all that type of shit. But yeah, that would have been nice to just kind of see Ward lick his lips at that one.
Yeah, I wish guys would call each other out more. You know, I've been kind of disappointed
with some of the
responses lately.
They need to stop talking badly about each other's side pieces. That's what needs to happen first. You know, let's address the biggest issues first.
Yeah, I wonder if Mr. Side Piece is fighting this weekend.
Oh, shit. Mr. Side Piece is fighting this weekend.
There'll
That's
be any
right.
mentions. I think Judah...
Yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah, I think Judah chilled out on that one, which is kind of too bad, but...
Well, you know, in the lead-up to Broner Malignaggi, we had talked about the kind of, I don't know, how should I put it, the semi-misogynistic nature of their pre-fight trash talk and how lacking in class the trash talk seemed to be.
Yeah.
You know, trash talk is one thing, but they were getting a little deep with that stuff. They were cutting pretty deep with some of that shit. And there hasn't been any of that in the lead-up to Judah Malignaggi. You know, I'm not really that thrilled about the matchup. I respect Paul Malignaggi. I think that he's obviously a really, really tough guy. He's going to give a lot of guys issues with his style alone. He takes a good punch, et cetera, et cetera. I thought he very clearly lost the Adrian Broner fight, and he's been kind of prattling on ever since that he's been, you know, that he got robbed. You know, he's talking shit about the sport itself. You know, judges don't know how to judge fights, blah, blah, blah. And then the lead up to this fight has been kind of small, it seems to me. I haven't really read a whole lot of it. I haven't seen a whole lot of it. And I'm not really that thrilled about Malignaggi as a fighter. You know, it might wind up being a good matchup in terms of, you know, them being more evenly matched than other guys we could see these guys against. But I don't know. Are you excited for this one? I'm excited for the card. The card itself I like, but the main event I'm not big on.
I think the card's good overall. I'm not level 10 excitement for this match. I mean, matchup. I don't think anyone really could be. I mean, it's, you know, there's not that much at stake. I mean, as much as they build it up like it's the Battle of Brooklyn. I mean, it really is, you know, two guys who are kind of past their best days. And but all that said, in its own way, I mean, I think it is a pretty good fight, and I think it actually could turn into be a good fight in the ring. You know, just based on what kind of stylistically what they bring in and what they have left and, you know, the boxers that they are, I think you'll see a lot of really good boxing, and I think it'll be a good atmosphere, you know. So, I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to the main event. I think the most intriguing fight of the whole weekend is probably, well, we'll talk about it later, but I think there Arizlandi Lara, Austin Trout, just in terms of, like, you know, real stakes for a guy who can move forward into a big fight with, you know, a division on the line type of thing, you know, that's the one you would look for. But Malinowski Judah will also kind of serve as a good indicator on Danny Garcia and Adrian Broner, because we've seen
them guys,
you know, and I don't know. They both looked decent in the last fight, that it's not like, you know, I mean, Judah rallied back and actually gave Garcia a pretty good fight in the last few rounds. Malinowski, I think, still, you know, even though he clearly lost, probably exceeded most expectations against Broner. And I thought he gave a really good effort. And I also think Broner is probably better right now than where Judah is right now. So I think this could be more competitive. So yeah, I mean, I think it's decent. It's okay. You know, next weekend's Broner and Maidana and Thurman and Soto Karas. I mean, that card, it looks a lot better to me. But overall, you know, this is a good one.
Yeah, I don't think that it's a crappy fight by any means, and it is at the very least, it is two names, and it is two guys from a similar area. You know, and so I think that there's a lot to be able to do some, like, local marketing. And so I'm not going to speak badly on the card because of that, because there probably is going to be a fairly decent showing. It's at Barclays, I think. Barclays. So I would imagine there's probably going to be a pretty good turnout. my buddy Stephen Baxter just reminded me of all the fucking times Zab says, you know what I'm saying? Oh, man, nah, it's going through my head, and I can't think of anything else. No. It might wind up being an interesting fight, because I think that Zab Judah is one of those guys where, at his best, he looks, you know, he looks like a beast. He can punch when he really sits down. He moves well when, you know, he actually remembers to move and whatnot. But he's just fragile enough that even guys who don't really have a whole ton of power can kind of stun him or, you know, make him think twice. Even Corey Spinks, you know, knocked him on his ass in that first fight. It was kind of a flash knockdown type of thing, but it was a legit knockdown. And so that being said, it was, you know, it probably had something to do with Zab's balance and his weird style too. Regardless, you know, there is kind of an opportunity there, I think, for Paul Malinowski to, you know, be successful. But it's also kind of a difficult fight for me to call, just because they're like you said, two guys at kind of a weird moment in their career where they're both probably a little bit past it. I'm kind of wondering about Malinowski myself, just because I don't really know what he's going to be thinking coming into this fight. And it's probably better for him if he really is convinced that he beat Adrian Broner. It's probably better for his psyche if he really does believe that. I don't know. I probably better if he does, but I don't. I know that's not what I saw. So, yeah, if nothing else, that's a good point, that it does kind of give an indicator of where Adrian Broner is. And, I mean, I don't really have too many questions about Danny Garcia at this point. He beat Matisse fair and square, and he beat him somewhat impressively. So, for me, I'm pretty convinced.
Yeah, no, me too. But, I mean, it'll just be kind of the thing where, like, you know, if let's just say somehow Zab Judah, like, blows away Paulie Malinowski and just outboxes him really badly and hurts him and stops him, you know, it's totally one-sided, then maybe we'll give Garcia even more credit for the Judah fight. You know,
for sure.
We'll say, you know, he beat a still decent version of Zab. But it's interesting, this fight with Judah and Malinowski, because I think most people probably would say that Judah, at his, you know, was a more talented fighter, fought at a higher level on his at his best. But, you know, really, the two of them, I mean, you are looking at guys who are kind of right beneath that, you know, top tier, who, you know, got into fights against really the top fighters but didn't win them. Now, Judah did a little bit, had a better career and had a couple better wins and was also, I think, more competitive against, like, Cotto and Mayweather. But they are they have had that kind of similar trajectory, you know. I mean, Judah may have been higher at one point, but, you know, over the last few years, I mean, you know, that's who these guys are. I mean, they're fighting on that second level. They don't win those big fights against the best fighters. So I'm curious, like, who is Judah a favorite in this fight? Because I haven't even looked
from
at
what
it.
from what I read yesterday, Zab Judah was a slight favorite. I don't know if that's right or wrong. I don't really know. I mean, I think that it probably could go either way, but you do also have to kind of take into account that if you're looking at Zab's last five fights, he's, I think, 3-2, could be 2-3, depending on whether or not you thought Matisse beat him. I thought that that was pretty close, but Matisse probably just lost. But, you know, you're right, though. They're both still relevant. It's not like, you know, it's two guys trying to grasp at straws fighting each other. They are still relevant, and they are still could they both still could be stern tests for guys coming up at 140 or 147, you know, depending on where they want to go. Although Zab's best, you know, actual win in the last few years was probably Vernon Paris last year, which, you know, I guess was something, but...
Or Matisse.
Which you probably should. You know, I thought that he could have won that fight and was fine with it. Yeah,
but,
there you go. That's better wording.
But I don't know. You know, and that's the thing. Like, these guys are both kind of, you know, at this point. I mean, I think with Judah, most would say, you know, he was inconsistent. You know, he had a lot of mental lapses. He had a lot of talent, but kind of shrunk in a lot of his biggest fights. With Malignaggi, I mean, I think most would say he probably maximized his talent in all reality. You know, he was probably never expected to be able to compete against guys who just were just better fighters like Ricky Hatton and Miguel Cotto. And he gave valiant efforts. And he did the same thing against Adrian Broner. I guess now it's funny because now they converge at this point in their careers. I mean, it's a tough call. And I kind of lean towards Judah, just because I think he has more, you know, potential weapons. But Malignaggi, I did think he looked really good against Broner, but you know, then I thought he looked like crap against Cano, and then he looked awesome against, you know, Sinchenko. So it's tough. I mean, you know, whereas Zab Judah, I mean, he got destroyed by Amir Khan, and then, like you said, just totally dominated Vernon Paris, who was thought to be a pretty good prospect. And, you know, he Garcia, you know, beat him pretty clearly and was really up big early. And Judah managed to, you know, hang in there and rally back and had some big moments late in that fight. So it's an interesting fight from that, you know, in terms of what's going to actually unfold and who's going to win. But it lacks, you know, the real high stakes of a fight where the winner potentially goes forward and bigger and better things. I mean, there's really nothing. The winner, what happens here? The winner moves forward and becomes, you know, a measuring stick for a guy like Keith Thurman or something like that.
Well, it sounds like I kind of sold you a little bit on the idea of Macklin Russ, and you're kind of selling me on the idea of Judah Malignaggi, I guess, because before I'm like that.
Well, I just like it. I like it on its own.
Yeah,
but, you know,
I'm interested.
I think what's interesting about it is that it is a really tough fight to call.
No, that's true. That's true. And if there's nothing else, you know, if nothing else, we do want competitive fights. You know, there's not really a whole lot you can do past that. Yeah, I mean, obviously, you want to match two action guys. You want to match an Adonis Stevenson and a Sergey Kovalev, or, you know, whatever the case may be. But in the absence of that type of, you know, opposition, competitive fights.
I think this fight could have some good exchanges, you know, good clean punches, because both guys are pretty clean boxers. They're not you don't expect that they'll be like holding each other and turn it into an ugly fight. It should be, you know, a fight that's fought where they're kind of bouncing around boxing and trading punches.
Yeah, and for God's sake, Zab, we know what you're saying, okay? So stop asking.
But I guess you have to favor Zab, right? Just being a little bit bigger puncher and probably being a little quicker.
I would think so, yeah. Although it's tough to say, because sometimes when you put two guys with, you know, similar styles, or maybe not even a style that's that similar, but they have similar attributes, like they're both kind of have an awkward style. They both kind of have weird rhythms, you know. Obviously there's a difference in power and whatnot, but I think that there are also two guys who probably could have stuck at 140 who are going to be at 147 now. So I think that sometimes when you come up with those types of matchups where it's two guys that are similar, it's things that are unexpected, you know, the things that you wouldn't expect to happen that wind up making the difference in the fight. Like if you put two boxers together, the guy who has the better power wins, or something like that. Or if you put two punchers together, the guy who has the better skills wins, you know, things like that. So it could wind up being interesting because both guys probably are going to be landing clean. Although, yeah, if you're looking at the power, needless to say, it's Zab Judah. Paulie just doesn't have any.
Yeah, he doesn't. Guess you could just end it there.
There is something, like I said, the Sphinx point before, but that's kind of a long shot.
Right, I mean, and Judah's not the most sturdy guy, but it would be really surprising if Paulie was able to actually, you know, stop him or hurt him.
If he hurt him or wobbled him, I wouldn't be, like, shocked, but if he stopped Zab Judah, that would probably be the biggest win of Paul Malignaggi's career. You know, I mean...
Actually... Yeah,
I guess
maybe.
That in itself is saying something, but regardless, that would be kind of big.
Maybe Diaz, but yeah.
Yeah, probably. Well, I don't know. I mean, there's some wiggle room for argument there, but knocking out Zab Judah, I would think, would be, I mean, considering who it is, considering that it's Paul Malignaggi with no power, that would be big. But,
yeah.
Well, you brought up what you thought was probably going to be the most intriguing fight of the weekend, and I tend to agree. Aris Landy Lara versus Austin Trout, no doubt. I think there's a couple possibilities there, and I think that it's probably likely that the fight won't wind up being all that entertaining. But from a skills standpoint, it's probably going to be pretty top-notch. What do you think on that one?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, I think in terms, they're probably the two best fighters on the card, and you know, a pound for pound sense or whatever in terms of like actually relevant guys in their divisions. You know, I mean, it's not unreasonable to think. I mean, assuming that you consider Floyd Mayweather a welterweight, and then the next best guys at 154 pounds would be, you know, well, Canelo was ranked at the top, you know, before Cotto's up there, and it's not unreasonable to think. Well, Trout's already beaten Cotto and obviously fought right there with Canelo, and Lara hasn't had those chances yet. But, you know, these guys are right there in the thick of that. And a lot of people think that Lara might be the most talented guy of the entire group. And so, you know, these are real players at junior middleweight. And it is, you know, it doesn't seem like it'll be the most appealing fight in terms of action and excitement and all that. But it's kind of a necessary fight to move someone forward in that pecking order. And, I mean, I think Trout did get kind of a raw deal. Even though, you know, I said that Canelo clearly won that fight under the terms it was fought, it was still, the whole thing was just a debacle with the open scoring and you know, totally changing the strategies in the last third of the fight when they knew that basically Trout needed a knockout. And then the fact that he lost, you know, in such lopsided decisions, you know, such lopsided margins on those cards showed that he never really had a fair shake. So I think he kind of got screwed there, and it's kind of bogus that he has to fight Aris Landy Lara, who's, you know, a really tricky, good fighter, in order to get himself back in that mix. But, you know, that's the task for him. And then Lara, you know, against Trout, I mean, he's got an opportunity to kind of, you know, compare himself to Canelo. And you know, these guys could potentially be involved in some huge fights down the road, you know, with Canelo, if it's a rematch with Trout. And, you know, with Mayweather always looking at up to 154, if there's an interesting enough opponent, who knows, maybe that would be possible. You know, if it's Austin Trout, who's also managed by Al Haymon. So this is, you know, it's a high-stakes fight, and, you know, two very good boxers. And, you know, when it first came out, I mean, I kind of favor Trout, so I'm going to stick with that. And I think that Trout, you know, if he boxes smart and just, you know, keeps his activity level high enough, he might be able to get a clear enough points win over Lara, who I think his biggest problem is at times if his opponent's not leading, like somebody like Alfredo Angulo, and that turned out to be an awesome fight, you know, if against a boxer like Trout, I think it's possible that Lara may go into some stretches of just too much inactivity, not throwing enough back, and, you know, that could cost him. So that was my gut when it came out, so I'm going to stick with it and say I think Trout Trout will win on points.
You know, and I don't have a clear argument against that pick, really. And I think that also goes to the competitiveness of the matchup, which is legit. I mean, they're both, you know, very skilled guys. They both kind of have a bit of an awkward style, although I think that I favor Harris Landilata, but not by a ton. And kind of how you were talking about how it seemed, at least from the outside looking in, somewhat unfair for Austin Trout to have to face Harris Landilata for, you know, the right to get back towards the top of the division. I think that it could also kind of go the other way. I mean, even though Lara won a version of the WBA 154-pound belt against Angulo, at the same time, you know, he's one of those guys that's kind of paid his dues at this point, and it kind of sucks that he winds up having to face a fellow spoiler in order to, you know, get to where he wants to be, which is where he hasn't really seemed to be able to get to in the past little while. You know, obviously there was that fairly crappy decision against Paul Williams. You know, I thought that was a very clear win for Harris Landilata, as most people seem to feel, although Carlos Molina sure looked like he beat Lada in the fight right before that. So, yeah, it's two guys who there's going to be a lot of, you know, straight punches thrown. There's going to be a lot of crisp type of stuff. And I, more than anything, I hope that there's not a whole lot of clinching or holding or stalling. I hope that there winds up being good action in that fight, although I'm not positive that's what it's going to wind up being.
I think there could be. It's kind of unlikely. But I think the way that Trout was fighting against Canelo, you know, you could get a similar fight in terms of action that fight had, which I thought that fight did have some drama and a lot of really good moments and punches. You know, it wasn't a brawl or anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was a fun tactical boxing match. I mean, that's kind of the best case scenario here, you know. And Lara's obviously a really pinpoint puncher. Seems like he's got some power. You know, it wouldn't shock me if somehow he's able to time and you know, drop Trout or hurt Trout. You know, even score a knockout, which would be incredible for his, you know, for his stock going forward. But you know, I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm kind of like letting my personal biases sway my pick here, but I just really like Trout. I think he's an incredibly classy guy. And, you know, the more I think about it, with that Canelo fight, I mean, I just think he gave him I thought that was a really good version of Canelo, and he gave him a really tough fight under those circumstances and probably deserved more credit than what I gave him when I first watched it. You know, so I like Trout, and I just, you know, I think it's, you know, he can, I think Lara's shown some vulnerability. He might not be as good as people were rating him after the Paul Williams fight. But, you know, this is a fight that's going to, it's so interesting because it's going to reveal a lot about these, both of these guys. And they both have a chance to make a big statement.
Well, you know, I think that there's also a kind of a point to be made that they've both, you know, really only shown flashes of brilliance, you know, if you will, in that Austin Trout, you know, he looks really good against a certain style. I scored the fight for him against Saul Alvarez, and I know I was probably one of the few who did, and that was fine. You know, I wasn't really going to take that to the grave or, you know, fight it with everything I had or anything, because upon looking at it again, it was a closer fight than how I initially had it scored and et cetera, et cetera. But there have also been times when, you know, he didn't look so hot. You know, I personally thought that against, Delvin Rodriguez, that, you know, there wasn't any question that he won, needless to say, but it wasn't especially entertaining. It was kind of a slow-paced, crappy fight. He slowed the pace down a little bit with Miguel Cotto, and, you know, in the rounds that he won, clearly they were not very exciting, et cetera, et cetera. But especially with Harris Landilata, we've seen him against the two fights that I just mentioned. He looked really good against Paul Williams, against that certain type of style. And then, you know, against Carlos Molina, the fight before that didn't look so good. And he's kind of almost done like a Guillermo Rigondeaux type of thing, where against some styles he looks great, some styles he doesn't look that great. So I don't know. There's some room for there to be, you know, maybe more action than I'm giving the fight credit for potentially having.
Yeah, you never know. You never know. I mean, it probably gets interesting if Lara can catch him with one of those, you know, straight left hands and hurts him. And then, you know, that would probably change Trout's strategy. I think the problem is it's hard to imagine Trout being able to hurt Lara.
I don't know. It's
Maybe. But, I mean, it just doesn't seem like he has that much power.
No, I would have to say if there was going to be an advantage of one guy having power over the other, it would probably be Lara, but... Oh, man, now you got me all thinking about it and analyzing it. But Lara goes into that kind of shell sometimes defensively where he doesn't do anything, you know, where he kind of just lets a guy punt. So
I don't know.
And I think, the guy to really take advantage of that, but we'll see.
Well, maybe not in terms of hurting him, but I did think against Canelo. And what you scored, what did you have that fight, Patrick, like 120, 106 for Trout?
I think I scored a 9-3 for Trout.
Yeah, so you had it for Trout. And, I mean, what I think he did – nicely in that fight was, you know, as a boxer, he was much more offensive. I mean, he kept a constant stream of activity, just snapping his jab. I think some of it was ineffective, but against a guy like Lara, who, like you said, is going to go into that shell sometimes and just kind of look for that perfect counterpunch, you know, you rack up points that way. And, you know, if Lara can keep kind of, I mean, if Trout can kind of keep his composure, just avoid something big in return, you know, maybe he can get some rounds and win a decision. I mean, that's just when it's come out. I mean, I've been kind of a Lara hater forever because I mean, I've grown to like the guy, and I thought that the fight against Angulo was really good. But I did think Carlos Molina beat him on Friday Night Fights, and I thought he looked, you know, Lara looked really underwhelming in that fight. And I also think he was fighting a diminished version of Paul Williams, and I think he was getting. You know, yeah, it probably was a clear win for Lara. I mean, I haven't seen that fight since whenever, you know, 2 years ago. But I thought that people were a little carried away with a lot of the rhetoric that, you know, like the HBO crew was going nuts saying they should stop the fight and Williams' health was at risk and all that. And I think it was the reaction of a guy who had been knocked cold in his last fight, like what would have happened if, you know, Pacquiao had been taking a lot of punishment against Rios. We would all get squeamish because we saw what happened. I think in the Paul Williams fight, it was a perfect example. I mean, yeah, Lara got screwed by the judges, but he, you know, and that's definitely not right. But there were a lot of stretches in that fight where he was so inactive, and Paul Williams, you know, outthrew him 2-1 in that fight. So you can kind of understand how a bad decision happens because the judges are counting punches thrown and that kind of thing. And you know, Lara had brilliant moments, and he was by far the more accurate, cleaner puncher, landed some huge shots. But, you know, Paul Williams was throwing, you know, so many punches in that fight, and there was times where Lara was just backing up and just playing defense, and the judges are scoring that. And it sucks, but it's the risk with that style that you're not going to get credit for defense.
Definitely.
You know, judges favor the aggressor.
Well, you know, obviously I think the lasting impression for a lot of people about that fight was just how many left hands. I mean, yeah, Lara was outlanded, but so many of those left hands just landed so clean. Like, I mean, you know, Paul Williams, especially because Paul Williams is about, you know, 7'15". And, you know, every punch that he was taking, it was like he was swaying in the wind like a fucking giraffe in a hurricane, you know? So I just came up with that analogy, by the way. So somebody give me some credit on Twitter. Thanks. Anyway, they were so obvious when those punches were landing clean. And so, you know, I think that's also was a part of it was that Paul Williams was taking like 100% of a lot of those punches. So that was part of it. But, looking back on it, because I did have to rewatch it, because I wound up actually writing an article not long after that, because there was a stretch of about 6 weeks where there were just a whole bunch of really questionable decisions and, you know, outcomes of fights and, like, really shitty officiating. And so I wound up writing an article, and I just watched all of those fights. And as I was watching that one, I thought that I did think that Lara won very clearly, although I could see in hindsight why someone would score it either much closer or maybe just barely for Paul Williams. Still thought Lara won, though.
Yeah, I mean, I did too, but I wasn't surprised. You know, sometimes you just kind of have a feeling that something funny could be coming, and it's not that outlandish that it could happen. And I mean, like, that's kind of what I, like, I remember watching that fight and with a whole group of people who were just stunned when the decision was announced and Williams won. And, you know, yeah, I thought it was bullshit, but at the same time, it was like I understood how it happened because there were a lot of rounds that were you know, Williams was just so active, and he wasn't, you know, missing every single shot he threw. So he was doing some stuff, and everyone was so concerned about Williams' health that, you know, it was like, and you're right. I mean, every really clean, crisp, I mean, any punch that I can remember from that fight was landed by Lara. I mean, he definitely deserved to win. There's no question. But it was one of those things where, you know, it wasn't like a clear 10-2 win or something like that. You know, I mean, it was probably like an 8-4 deal, maybe a 7-5, and there were a couple rounds where Williams threw 100 punches in the round that you could have just, you know, you could see how a judge could give it to him.
Yeah. No, I could. Well, applied to this fight this weekend, you know, that I guess could open the door for, like you said, that could open the door for Austin Trout to really just work and throw punches,
well, dude,
let his hands go, which is something that Lara doesn't
Marta
do that consistently. Yeah.
You know, I mean, he just has a style that judges do not favor that style, generally.
Yeah, I would have to say so. Well, I guess, I don't know, I guess we'll see what happens this weekend, but that's indeed an intriguing fight. Now, probably the loudest fight of the weekend is, of course, going to be Devin Alexander versus Sean Porter. There's going to be a hell of a lot of, like, karate chopping going on in that ring when that fight happens. It's going to be like, ha, 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 all night long. So, you know, that might even be, I don't know, I guess it depends on what type of action you like or whether or not you like the fighters, but that might even be the weakest matchup on that card. And, I mean, that says a lot about, you know, the weakest matchup in terms of, you know, whether or not a fighter, whether or not the fighter who's not favored would be able to overcome the odds. But I think that says a lot about the overall quality of the card. What do you think about that fight, though?
It's true. I mean, it's yeah, this, I mean, the fact that it is, you know, not, it is maybe the weakest matchup on the whole card. With the other fight is the Anthony Durrell and Saki Obika.
Yeah.
That's the fourth fight? Yeah, I mean, I think the Devin fight,
I mean, there's,
probably is the...
There's even stuff that's not going to be televised that, I mean, I would almost expect for them to be reaching for in a quadruple header. You know what I mean? Like, it's...
that's pretty solid.
Saddam Ali. Saddam Ali is fighting on the undercard. Julian Williams is fighting on the undercard. I mean, I would have expected those type of fights for them to be like, you know, the fourth fight on a quadruple header, but they're not really messing around a whole lot.
Oh yeah, they're putting it out there as far as star power. I mean, you know, Devin was headlining HBO cards by himself like a year ago, 2 years ago, and it's not like he's had some really, you know, devastating loss since then. I mean, it's basically his only official loss is to Bradley. So yeah, I mean, I like the fight.
At the Silverdome.
Yeah.
Silverdome.
It's a good venue.
Go ahead.
Sometimes you don't know if these things are going to work out or not. Ambitious plan.
I love that promotion.
I was down with it. That was one of the first face-offs they did, I think, with Kellerman. No, actually, that wasn't one of the first ones. They did one.
Now, that was somewhat recent. The face-off thing's been in, like, the last year.
Huh.
Well, anyway, go ahead.
Well, oh, yeah, that thing. You know, I favor Alexander. I think that he kind of became somewhat underrated because of how horrible he looked against Bradley, or the whole game plan that he had that night, and just the way, you know, basically wouldn't continue with the headbutt. You know, it was a decent gash, but it was just a culmination of all that stuff that just made him, you know, one of the least liked characters in boxing, it seemed like. And I always liked the guy. I think the problem is anytime you – Kellerman sometimes – and I think he was – probably the one responsible for it with Devin, when he starts anointing somebody as like the next great fighter, the next, you know, this amazing talent combination of Pernell Whitaker and Sugar Ray Robinson, you know, it inevitably creates a backlash. And Alexander suffered from that. You know, I think he was kind of like the trendy pick going into the Tim Bradley fight, and a lot of people thought he had the upside. You know, and he had that one, the one, you know, spectacular knockout where it was like, wow, he's a great boxer and speed, and he has power too. And he just didn't live up to that. But he has been kind of quietly, I think, a very good fighter. And you know, we can't forget that we're all looking forward to the Adrian Broner Marcos Maidana fight, and for good reason. Well, I mean, Devin handily picked apart Maidana when they fought in Maidana's first fight at welterweight. You know, no matter what the rationalizations, I mean, he beat Maidana better than anyone has in the last couple of years. So he's a very good fighter. I mean, he has a lot of natural ability. I think at times he may get a little bit predictable, and he maybe doesn't have a whole, you know, wide range of offense. But what he has is enough to compete with, you know, the best guys in the division and win some of those fights. And Porter just hasn't really impressed me in the same way. And I think that, you know, I think Devin's going to be just a little bit better and be able to kind of clearly win this. But it is really interesting. And there is a lot at stake because Devin is right in that mix, you know, with Amir Khan and, you know, the potential Mayweather suitors. And, you know, for Porter, I mean, this is his chance to try to get to that level. But he's a solid underdog here, and I think with good reason. You know, I think Devin's just fought much better competition. I mean, he's really has fought. You know, you look at the guys he's fought: Tim Bradley, Lucas Matisse. You know, and Maidana. He's, you know, those were top guys in the division at the time. So I think Porter probably falls short here.
You know, I'm about to offer something of a long-winded, backhanded compliment, and I don't really quite mean it that way, but this is going to come out that way anyway. I think that Devin Alexander, and we have both referenced him before, and I've said before I'm not a huge fan. The reason why, I think that Devin Alexander is the type of fighter who is a little bit more style than substance. I mean, he has quick hands, he has decent punching power, but when you really present conundrums for him, he doesn't really seem to know how to adjust or what to do. There was a stretch in, I guess it would have been about 2 years ago, roughly, whatever the actual dates were, it doesn't really matter, but it was the Kotelnik fight, the Bradley fight, and then the Matisse fight, and I thought that he very clearly lost all three of those fights. But he was given the decision over Kotelnik and Matisse fairly, well, not that closely against Kotelnik. I thought Andre Kotelnik absolutely jabbed his face in. I mean, it was not even close on my card. So I was kind of disappointed in that decision, but whatever, he got it. And then he lost against Tim Bradley. Like you said, it was not a very good strategy that he showed, just kind of moving forward and throwing. And he didn't really adjust from that either. And then against Matisse, same thing. I think it was 10 rounds instead of 12, but I thought that was a pretty clear Matisse fight as well. So regardless, he wound up getting the wins, and that just put him in better position to get better fights, which he did. And then subsequently, he's looked better. So I think that he has improved, even if only slightly. But if there's one thing that I can't fault him for or question, it's his chin. He's shown a really good chin over the course of his career. But all that said, I think that comparing him and then looking at Sean Porter is almost kind of like a poor man's version of Devin Alexander. And I'm not trying to totally shit on the guy, you know, aside from the fact that he's got the biggest grill this side of Gary Busey. I'm not trying to totally tear him down. It's just that, you know, he doesn't really seem to me like a guy that is a very solid fighter. I thought that he lost to Julio Diaz in the first fight. To his credit, he adjusted, won a rematch, etc. And on top of that, I forgot to mention, this will also be Sean Porter's first time ever going 12 rounds. And so when you combine the fact that I think that Devin Alexander's chin is very good, and that I really highly doubt that Sean Porter's going to have the punching power to take him out, combine that with the fact that I just don't think he's as skilled as Devin Alexander, and I don't think that Alexander is going to have too much issue in this fight. So, yeah, that was my long-winded backhanded compliment.
Yeah, I think you said it perfectly. You know, he has looked, you're right, he has looked better. Yeah, he was really like one of the pariahs of the sport. Everybody thought he's a kid who's just the next HBO hype, and he got a favorable decision against Kotelnik. I thought that fight was close. I think that it's not inconceivable that he could have won that fight. He also had a lot of really annoying habits. The most to me is that he flicks this jab that comes like 16 inches short of his opponent's face, you know, and he just flicks this meaningless jab into nowhere, and he's, you know, barking, and it's not accomplishing anything, and it's just, you know, yeah, he has quick hands, but he's not doing anything. And yeah, in these fights with guys like Kotelnik and Matisse, they're landing clean punches, and they're doing solid work, and you know, Devin's kind of just barking and shadow boxing, and somehow that gets enough points to win. I did think that those fights were closer than what the majority of people did, because I think that there is kind of a huge, you know, there was a lot of negativity surrounding him, and guys were looking for him to lose, and he's the last person anyone was giving a benefit of the doubt if there was any close rounds, aside from the judges who did give him the benefit of the doubt, you know, got him those decisions. You know, I think they were close enough fights where you can say he fought, you know, on close terms with guys really good, with, you know, good fighters. I mean, Kotelnik was a good fighter, and Matisse is, you know, a really good fighter, even though he just lost to Garcia.
Yeah.
And,
yes,
you know, even against Tim Bradley, I mean, that was probably, in my eyes, the most decisive fight, but you know, Alexander just looked horrible, and he really didn't do anything the entire night, and it ended under, you know, weird circumstances. But, yeah, since then, I mean, he has looked really good. And the competition hasn't been great, but Maidana's a solid guy. And if you look at what Maidana's gone on to do at welterweight, you know, to bust up Soto Karas and Josecito Lopez, you know, who we've seen them fight against the Bertos and Ortizes of the world, I mean, it makes Alexander look like a pretty credible guy there. And, you know, like you, I mean, I thought Diaz won the first fight against Porter. I just don't think any of those guys are very good. I think it's a huge indictment on Amir Khan that he struggled with Julio Diaz so much, and, you know, Porter was able to come back and make adjustments and beat him pretty easily in the rematch. I think Alexander's a better fighter. I mean, I would have favored Alexander against Khan now, even though I think Khan has, you know, maybe more natural gifts and does a lot of things that other guys aren't capable of. I just think Alexander's a solid guy, and he's going to give a tough fight to anybody outside of the guys who are at the very top of the division.
Well, real quick, just as you're on the tail end of saying that that's an indictment on Khan, there's been, you know, circulating rumors in the last few days that Mayweather versus Khan could potentially be announced sometime soon. Anyway.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a travesty, to be honest.
I'm just not into that fight. But as far as Alexander goes, yes, you do have a good point, and I should concede at least that much, that even, you know, if I'm scoring the Kotelnik fight, the Matisse fight, you know, the Bradley fight, if I'm scoring all of those against him, you know, those are not fighters that you need to be ashamed about for losing to, needless to say. Although it is worth mentioning that in a handful of fights, Devin Alexander has been warned for excessive holding and stuff like that. So it's not 100%, you know, letting his hands go in action there. It's he can get fairly boring at times.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and I think it's incredibly frustrating when he's in that routine of just kind of like bouncing around, throwing punches that are landing in midair and, you know, not even close to his opponent. I mean, I think that's kind of annoying to watch, too. You know,
yeah,
because basically,
for sure.
Like, and I felt like in the last half of the Kotelnik fight, that was like pretty much all he was doing. And that was kind of, you know, a little bit disconcerting. But I think, you know, for all those criticisms, I mean, he looked so good against Maidana. And I mean, maybe you can write that off to Maidana hadn't adjusted to the weight or whatever, but, you know, and Maidana's not some great boxer, but he's given a tough time to pretty much everyone that he's fought.
No, for sure. And, you know, he did basically – if you're going to say nothing else at all for him, he did what he had to do against Marcos Maidana, and he beat him, needless to say. And I wasn't entertained by it. I didn't really like it all that much. You know, I liked Maidana, so I was a little bitter about that too. But he did what he had to do, and he won the fight. And he obviously
outsmarted
Maidana.
Is that why you have that baby tattoo on your chest?
Shut up. No, I don't. That's on my lower back, actually.
Well,
my tramp stamp.
Yeah. He also beat Maidana up, you know, to an extent. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
He actually punched
him.
He wasn't just flicking in air like normal. You know, he actually was close enough that he landed some punches. So I thought that was a really impressive performance. And I'm trying to remember what he's done since then. I know he fought Phil LaGreco, the great Italian, you know, the next Rocky Graziano. But I think that's probably his best opponent at welterweight, right?
Well,
Maidana.
You're talking about Maidana, Soto Karas.
Oh no, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm getting Alexander and confused with Porter. Porter beat LaGreco. That was my mistake. Yeah, Alexander.
Wait a second. Where did I miss?
You're right. You're right.
Alexander's last.
How could
fight
I forgotten
was, Lee Purdy?
You're right. Lee Purdy.
Yeah.
Who in all
you're
honesty,
getting LaGreco and Purdy.
Kind of a similar level of opponent.
Yeah. Oh man, Marcos Maidana. Well, we'll be talking about him next week, needless to say. But the last fight on the card, and you know, I think that it's kind of intriguing, and I don't know, I'm not super jazzed about Anthony Durrell as a fighter myself. But although he has kind of earned a little bit of my respect in the last year or two, and you know, he has a good story behind him. Needless to say, but he's going to be fighting Saki Obika, and that's, you know, I don't even really know exactly how they're ordering the fights on the card. I absolutely have no idea, but I would assume that that's going to be either the opening fight or the second fight. I really don't know, but any of it.
Saki Obika, he's a pretty grizzled, rough dude with a gorgeous wife, and I don't know, I'm kind of on the fence about exactly what to think about Durrell Bika, because needless to say, Saki Obika is going to be coming in with the WBC belt that he took beating Marco Antonio Carabon. What was that? That was in June. And so, I mean, whatever, it's a belt, and how he got it is really not that important, because it doesn't matter, because he's not the super middleweight champion. But, Saki Obika has in the past kind of shown, number one, a very nasty temperament in the ring, and he's gotten in trouble, gotten DQ'd before, he's gotten points taken away, et cetera, but he's never been knocked out. He's a pretty hard dude. But he's also shown that he can be outboxed, and I think that that's pretty much what Anthony Durrell brings to the table. So what's your attitude towards that fight?
I'm looking forward to it. I don't know a whole lot about Anthony. I've seen him a couple times, but this, you know, it seems like a pretty big step up in competition. I mean, Bika is a solid dude, and if you beat him, you kind of belong at least in that top 10 at super middleweight, you know. And so this is a really good fight. I mean, just like the fight with Parabon, you know, people had talked up Parabon as being a prospect worth watching, and it was a close fight that I think Bika clearly won, but you know, that kind of showed it. Parabon wasn't ready to be on that next level. I mean, Bika he's only lost to the really top fighters in the division. You know, so it's intriguing. I mean, I was actually like, I think I was the one fan of Andre Durrell. So I'd always considered Andre to be like the more talented brother, and maybe. But I've read recently people say, no, Anthony is you know, has a ton of upside and is really talented. I haven't been like hugely impressed in what I've seen, but he hasn't really fought any worthy competition. So again, it's one of these fights where you're going to find out what Anthony Durrell's got, and is he for real? And I mean, he wins this fight, he's a top five guy at 168.
It's a big opportunity for him, needless to say. There isn't really any other way to say it except for that I do not like Andre Durrell and pretty much never have. But
well, I just
appreciate
his role in the post fight with Arthur Abraham. One of the greatest comedic events. Not to take it lightly, but.
Well, no, but I'm not even really going to throw it too much out there. But what did you think about that ending, about Abraham Durrell?
Well, I can't. It was just bizarre. I mean, I can't say for like anything that Durrell was faking it or anything like that. I mean, it looked fishy, but who knows? I mean, it was a clean shot on the side of his head when he was down. I mean, that's the bottom line.
Yeah,
and
no,
it was disturbing. I mean, it was disturbing. But it was also it was enthralling to watch because it was just
so fucking
crazy.
Weird.
I don't think that was funny. I mean, I felt genuinely bad for Andre Durrell, and I still kind of shake my head thinking about what's happened to his career. And he had one comeback fight, right? Where he just knocked out some guy. I think he had a comeback fight on Showbox, and then he hasn't fought in like a year and a half. So I think he has.
It was the Showbox where he and Jermaine Taylor both made their comeback. Like
the triumphant return of
fucking Showbox. It was ridiculous.
He looked better than Taylor, so you give him that. But he,
yeah.
Well, I just, the funny part I thought was Arthur Abraham calling him, saying he is actor. You know, accusing Durrell of faking, because he was just such a crazy villain turn out of nowhere. But I mean, it was just one of those like spectacles you'd only see in boxing. It was just such a weird, riveting scene. But how can you say that Durrell was faking? I mean, it was a solid Oscar-worthy performance if he was.
I'm keeping my mouth shut on that one, but it was crazy. I'll put that to it. Well, as far as Bika Anthony Durrell, what I was kind of leading into was that because of that type of stuff and because of not liking Andre Durrell, I was, kind of had a bias against Anthony Durrell then. I was like, because his brother, then he probably going to hate that guy too. But actually, in the last few years, even though he hasn't accomplished a ton and he hasn't really beaten anybody super worthy, he's kind of won me over. And the story of him getting diagnosed with, I believe it was non-Hodgkin's lymphoma a couple years ago and then overcoming that, that's the type of story you like to hear. You like to hear somebody overcoming something like that.
That's
and
right. I forgot all about
coming closer to a pinnacle of this division, and I think beating a Fakio Bika would, go quite a way in catapulting him there a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, you can argue that Bika deserves to be ranked right there behind like Andre Ward, Carl Froch, those guys, Lucien Boutte. I mean, Bika's right on that next level.
Yeah, I remember that when Bika fought Andre Ward, one of the cards was a shutout for Ward, and personally, I thought it was either the first three or first four rounds I thought could have gone to Bika because he kind of. It was almost like Bika taught Andre Ward how to do all the rough shit. Because in that fight, he didn't really see a ton of it from Andre Ward, and Bika was, roughing the hell out of him early on. So I thought that those could have gone to Bika, but he clearly lost regardless. But, yeah, I agree with you. He should be, in the kind of upper half of that division.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know. I mean, he's a tough guy. I think if you beat him, you're pretty good. I mean, that's what we're going to find out. Durrell has looked against, inferior opposition. I mean, there's no one he's fought since he's close to sniffing out the top of the division. And, Bika's been there and fought those guys and given them, decent fights. Like you said, I mean, the Andre Ward fight, Bika did make it rough and gave him it wasn't pretty, but he gave Ward a little bit of difficulty early.
Yeah, and I mean, there is something to be said for that, though, keeping it somewhat close with Andre Ward, even if it wasn't that long. But yeah, needless to say, for Durrell, beating an Anthony Hanshaw type definitely doesn't really say much in terms of being able to beat
the last fight that I saw.
Yeah, and that was his last fight, and that obviously doesn't say a whole ton as far as how he's going to do towards Fakio Bika, but I don't know. We'll see. It could be an interesting style clash, I guess. Yeah. And
before we have like 10 minutes left, man, there was so much shit to talk about. I can't believe we actually got through it all. I thought we were going to be rushing here at the end, but since we have a couple minutes, I did want to bring it up if we had time. Darren Barker is going to be fighting Felix Sturm in Germany this weekend as well. I think that's going to be like a Saturday afternoon type of thing for us. I'm going to miss it because I work, of course, but that's going to be a significant fight in Germany, needless to say. And then Darren Barker's coming off his trinket-winning effort against Daniel Giel in August. So do you have any opinion on that fight at all?
I think it's a really good matchup. You know, I think that Barker is coming off his best win, and he looked great against Daniel Giel. And he looked like an improved fighter from what we had seen against Martinez when he came up short, you know, his last time he fought the best. And Sturm is, you know, still giving guys tough fights. I mean, I think he's a really good boxer, a defensive boxer, and he's a good, you know, he's a crisp puncher and all that. But it does seem like he's kind of slowed down a little bit. And is getting in more and more fights where, you know, all of a sudden, like, he's been on the, you know, he's been involved in a few fights that had this kind of, like, could go either way decisions just because of the style that he fights. And so I'm really curious to see if you know, this is going to play out in that same way, or if Barker has kind of, you know, proven himself on another level and he can beat a guy like Sturm clearly. Sturm's a very good fighter, but I did think, you know, I mean, Sturm gave De La Hoya a really good fight in his prime, but, I mean, that was like 10 years ago. I did think at the time when Sergio Martinez became middleweight champion and he was campaigning and Sturm was kind of like considered the number two middleweight and a longtime title holder, I did always feel like Martinez was on another level than him at that point and that Martinez would have beaten him handily. I think Golovkin would beat Sturm handily now. So I think it's an interesting question. You know, it'll be interesting to see, can Darren Barker do that? You know, we saw Murray fight on pretty much even terms with Sturm. Macklin fought on even terms with Sturm. And Daniel Giel fought, you know, and those all had different decisions, a draw and you know, a close win for Sturm and a split decision loss for Sturm. They were all fights that were, you know, reasonably close. So I think it'll be interesting to see if Barker can separate himself from the pack because, I mean, that was a great fight against Daniel Giel and a huge win for him. And, you know, Sturm still, he's no joke. I mean, look what he did to Sebastian Zbeek, the infamous Zbeek that Martinez dodged for so long, right? You know,
oh, yeah.
So
total dodge.
Sturm is still, I think, one of the best guys in that division. And, you know, if Barker can beat him impressively, you know, you're creating a really nice alternative for a Golovkin opponent if Golovkin can't ever get Martinez into the ring.
You know, there's 160 is not generally thought of as like a super deep division or anything. I mean, I don't really see a whole lot of talk about the division itself anyway, at least not talking up the division. But, I mean, seriously, you make just any type of round robin between a Darren Barker, Felix Sturm, Sam Soleiman, Daniel Giel, Martin Murray, Matthew Macklin, you know, all these types of guys, and those are mostly European-based fighters. You know, you can make a really great tournament, you know, make like an 8-man tournament, just those guys. You know, obviously that would never happen, and I'm not living in reality saying that, but just the thought of it.
Yeah.
That's a good division. Those are some top-notch fighters right there. Nobody I just mentioned is a bad fighter, you know, and none of them are exactly, you know, unexciting fighters either. They all tend to be in pretty decent fights.
It's
160-pound division. It's decent.
It is an interesting landscape, and I think with obviously Martinez being the recognized champion and Golovkin clearly the number one guy behind him, you know, after that, I mean, a lot of us thought that, you know, because I think a lot of the boxing fans are kind of looking, you know, to the period after Martinez. If Martinez takes a, you know, money fight with Cotto or he retires or goes in a different direction, we're all looking at, okay, Golovkin's there. Is there anyone else in that picture who can kind of challenge him, or has anyone else even really stood out? And, I mean, Peter Quillen was a guy people were thinking, that's a great matchup. Well, then Quillen kind of struggled more than expected against Rosado. Didn't look great. I mean, if Barker can look great against Sturm, he clearly belongs, I think, atop that next level behind Golovkin. Right? Because it's possible that maybe he has improved. You know, he did come up short against Martinez. I think a lot of boxing fans look at a loss like that and say, okay, that should prove right then and there that's his ceiling, and, you know, he might be able to beat a guy like Danny Gill. He'll never be able to, you know, rise above that against a really special fighter, which we think, you know, Martinez was and Golovkin is. But he's making a case for himself, and, I mean, this is a great opportunity for him. And for Sturm, I mean, he lost his belts, what, last year? So this is, you know, I'm sure he wants to get that back and keep fighting in Germany, but he's got to be getting up there, right? He's probably about 36.
Yeah, he's 34, but he also kind of rose to prominence at a relatively young age. I mean, he was popular in Germany even before the De La Hoya fight, and then that just totally, you know, propelled him to friggin' stardom. We don't really recognize it over here because we don't see it regularly, but Sturm is one of the guys who, you know, can put 15,000 butts in seats fairly regularly over there. So, yeah, he's a star, and aside from that, he is an upper-level middleweight. And for Darren Barker to be able to beat him cleanly, that would, you know, going from Gill, which was, you know, I would understand if people scored that for Gill. I personally thought Barker could have taken it, you know, closely. But regardless, going from beating Gill to Sturm, that's respectable. And so that is a big opportunity for him, and it could change the landscape from that kind of 3-5 position that you were just talking about.
Yeah, all these guys are going to come into play somewhere down the road. I mean, you know, Golovkin needs opponents, and he's got the HBO backing. So while a guy like Sturm can make a lot of money in Germany, other fighters don't have that luxury. So to make the money, they're going to have to fight the guy who's, you know, and that's going to be Golovkin probably.
That's certainly what it's looking like. But, you know, if we're still, you know, 2 years from now or so, if we still have even just half of the fighters that I just mentioned, I think that we could be looking at some relatively fun times in middleweight, but we'll see. Oh, man, that was a lot of previewing and recapping. It's a lot of shit, man.
Yeah, well, we got two more weeks, right? And then that's about it for the year.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll have to talk about it, but we might think about, like, taking a break or something during
yeah.
those last few slow weeks.
We'll see you guys next May for the Mayweather fight.
Yeah, that's exactly what we watch. That's it. That's all we watch. Mayweather and Pacquiao. Well, let's bring it to a close then, eh?
All right, thanks, man. Enjoy
Everybody.
Enjoy your wife's birthday.
Yeah.
My favorite
yeah,
day.
I'm going to try to make sure it's not my last day. She beats my ass for doing the show. Anyway, thank you, everybody who listened in. Thanks, James, for being your normal, beautiful self. And everybody, check out Bad Left Hook, James writes for, and QueensburyRules.com that I write for. And we'll see everybody next week after all this crazy slew of fights. Thanks for listening in. Take it easy.